It was a break for the ages, leading to a breakthrough victory for Brian Campbell on Sunday at the Mexico Open. Sometimes the golf gods just smile on you. So what does Campbell's unlikely win have in common with Nick Dunlap's a year ago? You're going to find out. Plus, newly announced European Solheim Cup captain Anna Nordqvist joins the show. We're going to ask her how Europe's looking to bounce back and win the 2026 Solheim Cup in the Netherlands as Golf Today starts now.
Golf Today.
Hey, hey, come join us here on Golf Today. For the next hour, George Zavarica is hanging with Eamon Lynch. What a wild Sunday we saw at the Mexico Open. Wasn't the best golf down the stretch, but it was certainly an exciting finish, Eamon.
It was entertaining, and I guess it's proof that drama comes in many forms, as do winners. I mean, it's hard to imagine, George, a more jarring juxtaposition in everything we saw yesterday, not least the fact that you have one guy in a playoff who just seems destined for greatness and has since his amateur days, and another guy who just seemed destined to be part of the supporting cast in the professional game. That's not how it turned out.
You had the longest and the shortest hitters on the PGA Tour going toe-to-toe and David prevailing over Goliath, but it was thanks to one of the best breaks you're ever going to see in a playoff on the PGA Tour. This went to a second playoff hole. Brian Campbell on the tee. Oh, no. Flares it dead right somehow. Rattles off the trees and back into play, Eamon.
That was literally the only good thing about that shot, was where it ended up, George. But here he is with his third, having put himself back in position. A wedge into the par five. 68 yards. That's a beauty.
So that would put the heat on Potgieter. Ulrich Potgieter had put in the greenside bunker in two, played his third to here, misses the birdie putt. So Campbell with the shorty to get his first win on the PGA Tour. Oh, you bet. What a moment and what a finish for Brian Campbell with his girlfriend on hand to take it all in. For the second straight year, we see a first-time winner in the Mexico Open at Vedanta.
It's been a long road for Brian Campbell. He had his tour card back in 2017, lost it that season. He lost his Korn Ferry tour card in 2021, played just three events on that tour in 22, got the very last spot to keep his card on that tour in 2023, made it to the PGA Tour, and is now a winner. And after the win, Campbell spoke about those final day nerves.
Thought I was going to throw up at multiple times during the day. That last hole, I guess I just wanted to keep the party going a little longer, but not by design. It was really fun to play against him. We had some guys further back coming up to get us too, so we had a lot to think about.
What advice would you give to other players to get to this moment who maybe lost their heart and trying to get back?
Trust yourself. You know what you're capable of. You've put in years of hard work. It's not always going to go your way, but you really just got to trust the process. Keep digging deep, you know, and just really believe in yourself. It's hard to do that out here when, if you don't win, you're a loser. You know, it's kind of an interesting concept, even second place. But so we have to deal with that every week. But you really got to just trust yourself, believe in yourself, and go take care of business. I almost stopped golfing about 2 years ago. I was at second stage. I made a quad on a par three and thought I shot myself out of Q school, and then somehow managed to fight back the next day and shoot a really nice number, got myself back in it enough to get to final stage, and that led to last year, and had a really strong last year. So it's crazy how quickly things can change. And I'm so blessed to be in this position.
For Brian Campbell, it was his first ever top 10 on the PGA Tour, and it's a win. His previous best finish was a T12. You look back to 2022. This happens maybe once a year on tour. You see a guy who's never had a top 10, and then they break through to get that first win. But The guys on this list last year is Matt McCarty, the young stud who had won three times on the Korn Ferry Tour, gets promoted and wins early in his PGA Tour career. Nick Dunlap did it as an amateur. Nico Echevarria did it as a fairly young guy. Ryan Brem, the only other player in his 30s to do so, and that was at the 2022 Puerto Rico Open. We look at the golf landscape, and you have these type of Cinderella stories that happen from time to time. Where do they fit in the current landscape of where professional golf is heading towards?
They're probably going to become rarer and rarer as time goes on. I mean, there is an argument that as entertaining as that finish was yesterday, it does kind of obscure a weakness in the PGA Tour product in that it wasn't a particularly strong field, it wasn't a particularly exciting event. And as it moves towards a for-profit model, you're likely to see more and more pressure come on the tour from its investors to not, as they would, might see it, dilute the product. But this is also an avenue for these kind of stories. And I mean, that was such a throwback win yesterday. It almost felt like Corey Pavin was back on tour and winning again. I mean, he's ranked 186th on driving distance in the PGA Tour. There is no one shorter than Brian Campbell on the PGA Tour, 277 yards. I think you've got bat speed that's greater than that out there, George. Now, he was 74th out of the 77 guys who finished in Mexico, so that was actually a good week for him in terms of driving distance. But he's really straight, and he hit his approach shots really well. And around the greens, he was second in the field, which was ultimately where the weakness came in with Potgieter as the day went on. To me, it's a great story. It's an entertaining story in its way. It's an endangered species kind of story out there as well. You're not going to see guys like that get that kind of result very often. They really have to be opportunistic and get the breaks.
Or get that type of bounce. Sometimes we'll see a fortunate bounce where maybe it bounces out of a bunker or a putt lips in, but you don't see a break like this where it's a tee shot that was going to be OB. And he said he felt like he was going to puke. He was so nervous. This was a nervy swing, a flare right. Every 15 handicapper has felt it where you immediately, when it hits the club face, you're thinking, oh, no, that's cooked. Not quite, though. The trees had different ideas in mind. Is that somehow worked its way back into play? So Brian Campbell is caddy. What do they do appropriately? It's part of the celebration. They go and cheers the tree.
And it would be very easy for us, I said, you know, to think, well, Brian Campbell had never been in that position to win as a professional. And that's the nerves of a rookie in that position, but it happens Hall of Famers as well. Let's take a look back, Pebble Beach, 1984. And this might be the luckiest break in the history of the PGA Tour. Hale Irwin is one back of Jim Nelford, who's in the clubhouse. Snap hooks this one into the Pacific, bounces off the rocks, comes back in. Hale Irwin then hit 3-wood wedge to make birdie to force a playoff. The playoff went to the 16th hole, where Hale pops guide his driver into a fairway bunker and then hit 2-iron in there close to win the playoff. So these breaks do happen. It's the ability to capitalize on those breaks, I think, is what's really a testament to a guy's character. And Brian Campbell yesterday could easily have just been reduced to a pile of jello from that tee shot, but he didn't. He focused on what was at hand. And I give all the credit in the world to Potgieter for his interviews afterwards. He should have won that tournament going away yesterday. The short game really betrayed him on Sunday, and he's going to know that. And he also knows that his opponent got an extraordinarily lucky break on the last hole of that playoff. You wouldn't have known that from his interview, though. I thought he was very mature, very classy. He acknowledged in a quite honest manner what his shortcomings were during the day and just acknowledged that he learned from it and move on.
Yeah, I mean, he has a really strong grip, a closed club face around the green.
You mean you're not supposed to do that? That's how I chip, George.
Well, I know that Ernie Els, fellow South African, has had conversations with him where that's the one area of his game for him to take the next step. He has all the talent in the world. We can see it. One of the longest hitters in the PGA Tour. He's a player who you think is going to win soon on the PGA Tour and going to be a name that we look out for going forward, because the package that he currently has, even with a deficient short game or around the greens, save for one incredible break, was good enough to get his first win on the PGA Tour very early this season.
And that's a realization you want to have at the age of 20 rather than suddenly start dealing with it at the age of 35 out there on the PGA Tour. He's ahead of the game.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, that's for sure. All right. We got more to come in case you missed it on Thursday, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan returned to the White House to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump for the second time this month. The meeting, which was initiated by Trump, also included Tiger Woods and Adam Scott, who are player directors on the circuit's policy board. Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the chief governor of the Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, on hand as well. So here was the statement on Thursday. We have concluded a constructive working session at the White House with President Trump and His Excellency Yasser Al-Rumayyan. Thanks to the leadership of President Trump, we have initiated a discussion about the reunification of golf. We are committed to moving as quickly as possible and will share additional details as appropriate. We share a passion for the game and the importance of reunification. Most importantly, we all want the best players in the world playing together more often and are committed to doing all we can to deliver that outcome for our fans. So you've been tracking this story. We're on hand, part of the coverage this past Thursday. So what's the latest in the negotiations?
I think the tour executives who went to that meeting and the player directors and Tiger and Adam Scott expected more of a breakthrough than perhaps they got. And that was reflected in the comments that we saw from Tiger and from Jay Monahan in the couple of weeks earlier, kind of encouraging this sense of momentum that things were happening. And based on folks that I've talked to who are familiar with what happened, I think the Saudis are digging in their heels a little bit more. They seem determined to keep shoveling cash into the furnace that is LIV, a product that doesn't seem to have any traction, certainly doesn't seem to have any commercial future. But what the terms that Yasser Al-Rumayyan are willing to accept in terms of what the landscape looks like, it still seems to be somewhat up for grabs. But I do think there's a... We've gotten to a scenario now, George, where I think he needs a deal a lot more than the PGA Tour needs a deal. I think the PGA Tour wants a deal. He needs a deal.
Why would you say that?
Because he doesn't know where else to go. The PGA Tour product is diminished. That there's no arguing that. It's been diminished by the taking away of some of the players. His product has no future at all and has become a black hole of cash and his own pride. And there's no sense, there's no metric by which it's deemed to be successful. And now that Donald Trump has gotten involved in this, and Donald Trump speaks the language of TV ratings, that's Donald Trump's only metric to determine whether or not something is successful or not. And this has now gone from being a relatively minor, in the grand scheme of things, commercial dispute between the Public Investment Fund and one of its potential partners. And they must have hundreds of those disputes going on any given day. Now it's become a White House summit, which means Yasser Al-Rumayyan's boss is starting to pay attention to this. And if his boss is starting to pay attention to it, and as you read in the financial press repeatedly, the idea that the Public Investment Fund has to start focusing more on domestic products and less on these kind of fee-taking endeavours outside, there's nothing that recommends LIV at all. I think Al-Rumayyan's going to find himself under considerable pressure to reach a deal. He's trying to get better terms than he ought to get.
But LIV's side, you say there's no commercially viable standpoint with LIV currently. They just had their most successful event, LIV Golf Adelaide. It had more than 250,000.
Which is the exception that proves the rule every
which
year.
Is more, they had more than 250,000 viewers in an overnight time slot mm-hmm. on a competing network, which is actually a really good number considering the hours. So I'd say small sample size. They've only had two events with the new television partner. You can't fully write off that it's not commercially viable when you only have two
well, you
data
can,
points.
You can write off that it's commercially viable when they're $5 billion in the hole. You show me a plan where LIV is going to make back $5 billion. This is a black hole that has no commercial future at all. LIV Adelaide has always been their most successful event. The rest of them produce numbers and a fan engagement that just isn't anything that is going to suggest that there's an upward trajectory with this product at all. And we're now 4 years into this.
Yeah, we've definitely... it's crazy to think that it's already at the four-year point from when LIV first launched in London in the summer of 2022. There was all the intrigue of what the league would look like. Now it is year four of a schedule and competition, third year now that they have a full slate going forward in.
But somebody's still enjoying their fees from this product, I suppose. Well, we're going to have more on this White House meeting coming up a little bit later in the show. But next up, Europe has a new Solheim Cup captain. It's a familiar face as well, Anna Nordqvist. Veteran of nine teams will lead her squad into next year. She's going to join us right after this break.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Time now for Golf Today. Flashback to the 2024 Solheim Cup last September. Robert Trent Jones Golf Club. The U.S. defeated Europe 15.5 to 12.5 to claim their first Solheim Cup victory since 2017. The United States overall holds an 11-8 advantage in Solheim Cup competitions. The 2026 biennial competition will be contested at Bernardus Golf. This will mark the Netherlands' first time hosting a Solheim Cup. The course has already hosted three editions of the KLM Dutch Open on the DP World Tour. The golf course was designed by renowned American golf course architect Kyle Phillips, who also created iconic courses like Kings Barnes, the Grove, and Yas Links. And news today, Sweden's Anna Nordqvist has been appointed European captain for the 2026 Solheim Cup. Nordqvist was a playing captain in 2023 and again in 2024 in what was her ninth time representing Team Europe in the Solheim Cup. She has been on the winning side five times and is one of Europe's most successful players, a three-time major winner. She has amassed a further six LPGA Tour titles and five total LET titles, including the 2022 Dutch Ladies Open.
Now, Nordqvist also produced one of the great moments in Solheim Cup history. This was back in 2013 at Colorado Golf Club. It's the first ace in the history of the event. She's playing with Caroline Hedwall. They went on to win their match that Saturday over Morgan Preston and Jessica Korda. That was part of a dominant European victory, 18-10, over the United States. And here is the bio of Anna Nordqvist. As George mentioned, three major championship victories, nine total LPGA Tour victories, and one of the most experienced Solheim Cuppers in history. And the newly appointed captain joins us now, Anna Nordqvist. Anna, congratulations on the role. You've played nine Solheim Cups, the last two playing as a vice captain. You're still very much a competitive golfer. So let's get to the elephant in the room here. Is there any prospect that you might have the ambition to play, be a playing captain next year?
No, I mean, getting the honor to be a captain, I think you kind of put yourself aside. I've had the honor to play in nine Solheim Cups and been very fortunate to create a lot of cool memories. And I'm now looking into the captain's role. I would think it would take a lot of effort from the other 11 girls than if I were ever to play. But I'm excited about this new role, and I hope the other girls are going to look forward to having me as a captain. And it's going to be an exciting journey ahead for sure.
You've been in the arena for nine different Solheim Cups. You've had such a decorated career. From a mindset-wise, you want to be in the arena. So how big a shift is it now going to be, assuming that you're not a playing captain, to then just be on the sidelines watching your team of 12 trying to avenge the Solheim Cup loss from a year ago?
Yeah, I think being a playing vice captain in the last two Solheim Cups under my good friend Suzanne was a learning experience I really enjoyed. I think as a player, it's easy just to look at, you know, you show up there on the Sunday or the Monday and everything is really taken care of. But it's just so much work behind the scenes. And it's just you need a lot of people around, a lot of helpers. There's just a lot of people that are putting in so much work that we kind of take for granted as players. I kind of just being part of all that and seeing that as, I think, just kind of, I don't know, motivated me to be able to want to do a good job in this new role. And I think also like doing it while I'm still on tour helps me know the players and know the captains. And I think that's what my big motivator was to do this job now, instead of maybe waiting a couple of years.
You've played under, I think, six different captains during your nine Solheim Cups, Anna. Is there any one lesson you took from one of those captains that you really plan to use as part of your strategy in this job?
Yeah, I think the captain that I look up to a lot is Beanie, Katrina Matthew, and I already had dinner with her in Thailand last week. So, I think the process has already started, and I'm already learning and try to do my best to get some great advice, and a lot of people have reached out. And now it's official. I think it's a little bit easier maybe to do the job. But yeah, I'm looking forward to learning as much as I can. But I think at the end of the day, I'm going to just try to be myself and do the best I can to lead the way in a way, lead the team in a way that I hope the players enjoy.
And speaking of that leadership style, I mean, golf is such a solitary pursuit, but you have that 1 week a year with the Solheim Cup where you get to be in a team room, which you've experienced 9 times. So how would you describe what your leadership style is going to be like?
Yeah, I think most people who know me knows I'm not much for drama. I don't like gossip. I'm pretty well, down to earth. So I actually had a good conversation with Pia Nilsson a couple of weeks ago. She's a good friend of mine, and she actually raised some she had a couple of good points. She's been captain, and she has a lot of experience. And as a past captain, she shows up to every single one. So I enjoyed picking her brain. And she said to me a lot about was think about how you want to be as a captain when you get there. It's easy. I mean, there's so much going on, especially I think there's a lot of things you can plan for the 2 years leading up to Solheim Cup, but there's always things that are going to happen that you maybe don't expect will. So she said, just make sure you know how you want to be as a person or, what kind of state of mind. And I think I'm a pretty calm and calm person, and I like to kind of bring that mindset into the players. But I said, I just want to be myself and try to do my best to surround myself with a good team, with a lot of helpers, and just bring that kind of atmosphere. I've always been a big believer in good preparations, and when the week get there, you just go and play. So I think just trying to make it easy. And I think Katrina was really the one that simplified a lot of the routines. As we know, it's a very long week and long days, and she kind of helped ease our mind because I think that's how she enjoys things as players. I think ever since, we've seen a little bit of a change in how the weeks are.
You may be a calm person now, Anna, but we've seen that the Solheim Cup has a way of making calm people very emotional as well. Particularly the last few years, been a lot of close matches. You've 5 times your team has left with the trophy, 4 times you've left without it. I'm curious, what's the more intense feeling? Is it the joy of winning or the pain of losing with your team?
Well, Sunday night is a lot more fun the times when you have won. I will say that. But I do believe Solheim Cup should all be about, you know, win or lose. Women's golf should always win. I mean, the Solheim Cup family and Ping has put in so much work and effort over the years to support the game. And I think that's the most important. But when we won in Colorado in 2013, it was a very special feeling. Also winning in Toledo in 2021, where we literally did not have any single supporters out there. And I think we closed out the match, and some of the matches were still on 15, and basically all the spectators were just left. Like, they walked out of the golf course, so there wasn't really many for the closing ceremony. So I feel like over the years, I've been fortunate to be part of so many cool teams, win or lose. Definitely, I think DC has left a lot of good motivations for the European to come back strong. Spain was a tie match. It was nice to see how well Stacey's teams perform and how that was probably the best U.S. team I've ever seen as far as in attitude and how they carried themselves and how well prepared they were. So it's just so many different memories, and that's what's so cool about Solheim Cup, because you never know what's going to happen, and no lead is big enough when it comes down to it, because like you said, there's a lot of pressure, and it means so much for not just me but for all the other players, because you're playing for something bigger than yourself.
You're going to create new memories in 26 at a site the casual golf fan may be unfamiliar with in the Netherlands. What are your expectations for what we're going to see next year?
I actually do think we're going to see something a little bit different this time around in the Netherlands. I was fortunate to meet the owner, Robert, a couple years ago. I played about 12 or 13 holes on the golf course. I don't know how many people has played golf in the Netherlands, but a lot of the kind of style of golf is a little bit more like an inland links course. So it might play a little bit firmer. But Bernardes, it's a relatively new course. It was built in 2018. It's hosted some DP Tour events as a Michelin star restaurant in the clubhouse. Like, it's a really cool piece of property, and I think between the owner and the Dutch Golf Federation, like, they had a vision of wanting to put on like a special event, and meeting with them, knowing some of the staff that's been on board of bringing the Solheim Cup to the Netherlands, I think just seeing their vision and hearing about all these cool ideas also kind of made me, I think it helped push me maybe wanting to pursue this role already now, since I'm still playing. IMG is coming in to help run the event. But I just think it's going to be a really cool experience. Amsterdam is really close by, and it's just such a center location in Europe, so it's quite easy to get to, and also, like, there's a lot of flights from the US to Amsterdam, so I think we're going to see a really cool fan experience, and I have a lot of ideas we've been, like, going back and forth with, so it's just cool to be a part of an event, just wanting it to be something special for the fans and not only the players.
Well, it sounds spectacular, and I know in the blink of an eye it's going to be 18 months from now for the 2026 Solheim Cup. Congrats on the news, and thanks for joining us on Golf Today.
Thank you.
We're just going to look at the last six Solheim Cups contested. This going back to 2015, even split three apiece with the U.S. winning most recently. Before that, though, Europe had had a nice run, capturing three straight in 2019. 21 and 2023 as well. More golf today when we're back after this.
Welcome back to Golf Today. PGA Tour is heading east for this week's Cognizant Classic at PGA National in Palm Beach Gardens. The start of the Florida Swing, Jordan Spieth is a late add to the field in what will be his tournament debut. Coming off wrist surgery in the fall, he's played three times in 2025, T4. At the WM Phoenix Open being his best finish. And this, of course, is the start of a four-week swing through Florida. The Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill next week, followed by the Players, and then wrapping up with the Valspar Championship, March 20th through 23rd. It's time now for Golf Today Roundtable, as we welcome in our Golf Channel senior writers, Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner, who are the Woodward and Bernstein of Golf Channel, appropriately enough for the subject matter these days. We're going to head back outside the ropes. Rex, what are you hearing in terms of the fallout or aftermath of that White House meeting on Thursday that involved Donald Trump, Jay Monahan, Yasser Al-Rumayyan, and the two player directors, Tiger Woods and Adam Scott?
Eamon, I showed up this morning at the Cognizant Classic, and I had two players stop me on the way into the media center to ask exactly where we stand. And there is a policy board meeting here tonight in South Florida. I'm not quite sure what's going to come of that, but certainly everyone is on pins and needles after last week's meeting. I think there was an idea, there was a feeling going into that meeting of optimism that maybe they could come up with some sort of deal, at least in principle. And when you meet with the president for 4 hours and come out with nothing to show for it, I think there is a level of frustration, and that's sort of the feeling on the grounds right now. Everyone is anticipating that there's going to be some sort of deal. What exactly that looks like, I think there's a lot of different interpretations. And at this point, everyone just wants it to be done.
Lab, wasn't it kind of to be expected, though? I mean, that's kind of the one of the first times they've had everyone together with President Trump involved to think that a deal was going to be hammered out exactly from that. If you're Yasser, you probably want to try and play whatever cards you can to get a more favorable terms in the near future, if you think that's even a possibility.
Yeah, I certainly understand that point, George, but there does seem to be a marked shift in tone from meeting one to meeting two. And the fact that they had 4 hours in the White House with the leader of the free world and were still not able to hammer out a deal, I think speaks the complexities of it. Keep in mind, President Trump last year somewhat infamously said it would take him about 15 minutes to strike a deal between these two warring sides. Now, Trump did say over the weekend that there's still a, quote, really good chance of a deal getting done. But it's pretty obvious that there's legitimate sticking points, legitimate obstacles, and there probably is some leverage play going on here on both sides as well.
Rex, has the leverage diminished somewhat on the Saudi Arabian side here in the sense that they are almost $5 billion in the hole? They don't have anything to show for it. Presumably, the boss is now paying attention, and the threat to keep spending money seems to have lost some of its potency, because since John Rahm, 14 months ago, the only signing has been a YouTube golfer. Do you think the tour is as intimidated now by the threat to keep spending money recklessly as it might have been a year or two ago?
I think $5 billion speaks volumes on that front. And if you look at where we were just a year ago, right after the John Rahm signing, I think there was the idea that was the ultimate leverage play, that if you could keep poaching players, that eventually the PGA Tour had to come to the table. Now, we have gone a year without any significant signings, as you pointed out, and I think everything swings now in the Tour's direction. They have time on their side. If you cannot turn this into a profitable endeavor, and I'm talking about LIV Golf, Team Golf, then there's no reason for the Tour to rush to the table other than trying to reunite the game, whatever that's going to look like. So, yes, I think it's fair to say at this point in time that whatever leverage exists is on the Tour's side, especially having President Trump in office. He clearly has an interest in this, and he clearly has an interest in the deal. That only benefits the Tour.
Lev, I feel like since the Senate subcommittee meeting first occurred back in July of 2023, we keep trying to parse together timeline for how imminent a deal may be. Based on the recent developments, what does your gut tell you looking forward?
Well, George, I think the timing now is very interesting, and that the Tour remains in win-now mode with fans of the product. Then you start to see, I think, a little bit more transparency, a little bit more accountability. I was at Pebble Beach where they trotted out some Tour executives to sort of go over the fan forward survey, trying to show that there are going to be, you know, improvements made to the PGA Tour product. Rex was at Torrey Pines for the Genesis Invitational, where Jay Monahan, the commissioner of the PGA Tour, was scrumming with reporters there. They're trying to be a little bit more front-facing to at least give the appearance that the PGA Tour is in a position of strength and they are picking up wins. I think, obviously, everyone had circled the Players' Championship as a potential spot where the PGA Tour would have liked to announce a deal. That seems to be at least annually a spot where they, you know, send out their latest and greatest and really get people excited about the PGA Tour product. Augusta National is not going to want anything overshadowing the Masters. And so it's hard to say that you could see that in the run-up to a deal as well. And so it feels like now or potentially waiting just a little bit longer after the year's first major. But that's complete speculation on my part.
Ryan, just staying on that point of the Tour wanting to communicate to its fans the possibility of a win, should they should they keep updating at the level they're doing when there isn't actually a deal? I get that they want to be transparent and there's no updates whatsoever coming from the other side of this conversation. Are they in danger of trying to kind of update fans and then eventually just make fans more weary because there isn't actually an update to give other than the suggestion of momentum?
Could be kind of the theory that this is just an update, that there is no update. But I think, you know, over the past couple of years, we've been critical on this program. Rex and I have been critical on the podcast or on golfchannel.com about PGA Tour leadership and not taking accountability. And obviously you saw what happened June 6, 2023, sort of the blindsided nature of that deal getting announced as well. It's hard to be critical of them for saying they're MIA when it seems like the entire golf world is burning, and now be critical of them for trying to be more transparent, trying to be more accountable, trying to be more front-facing. I would certainly prefer the latter in the situation we're getting now, as opposed to sort of the cone of secrecy that seemed to exist surrounding the PGA Tour over the past couple of years.
Yeah, kind of damned if you do at this point in time until a deal is actually put on the table. Guys, we're only at the halfway mark. We're going to have more with Rex and Lav after this short break here on Golf Today. Eamon, you know what? If you're in the market for a podcast, why don't you check out, take a listen to the Golf Channel podcast with Rex Hager, Ryan Lavner. If you miss any of Golf Today, you can hear us on the Golf Today podcast, which includes the best interviews from our show. And be sure to subscribe to the Golf Channel YouTube page. We got Rex Hager, Ryan Lavner with us, part deux of our Golf Channel roundtable. And we're got to touch on what we saw over the weekend, which started trending and blowing up in golf Twitter. A-Lim Kim, the aim point on the LPGA Tour. And we got to show the video here of the putt, Lav, before we get you to weigh in. So this was her birdie chance. Then she walks up. And the screen grab's probably a little more egregious than what actually unfolded. But she's got, call it, what, 10 inches maybe on the comeback, a foot. So does the aim put there. Dottie Pepper then said, we've lost the plot. If you continue the video after the fact, she would then just walk directly back and tap in. But with the aim point, are we making a mountain out of a molehill when we see these one-footers where people are using aim point, or should there be tweaks going forward to how it's used in the professional game, Lav?
I mean, optically, it's clearly a bad look. You don't want to have someone who's stomping and marching around the cup for particularly a putt of that short of a distance. However, this was not, to me, the most egregious example. We saw Max Homa either a year or two ago who took 2.5 minutes and then ended up missing about a 10 or 15-foot putt. And so I still think it's really hard to ban the process because I think just like a shot clock implementing it in golf, it's really hard to regulate when it starts, when it stops. I think it's just really tricky in that respect. And if you do not do aim point properly, it does take more time than a player who is probably circling it from multiple angles. But I think the foremost authority on aim point and its like worthiness and importance in the game of golf is Rex Hoggard, who actually uses aim point. I can't imagine that he uses it correctly.
I don't use it correctly, to be clear. However, I do want to point out in that beef last week between Lucas Glover, who called out those who use aim point, saying it slows down the pace of play, I think Colin Morikawa probably landed on a best, to your point, that yes, if you do not use it properly, it's going to take too long. That's clearly an example of not using it properly.
And just optically, like it sucks. It doesn't look good when you're watching a broadcast. There's got to be ways to tweak it, especially when it just slows down to a glacial pace in and around the greens, Eamon.
I tend to agree on that, but I think to Ryan's point, there's definitely more egregious examples out there than what we actually saw from A-Lim Kim if you run the full video this weekend. It is one of those housekeeping matters that you think professional golf is going to have to deal with. And on the subject of housekeeping, Rex, there is a policy board meeting of the PGA Tour happening today, as you mentioned. Are you expecting any news out of that? Are they likely to approve the format change that's being discussed for the Tour Championship, for example?
Yes, I think that's on the agenda, and that's probably going to be one of many items on the agenda. Let's go back to last week. We just had a long conversation about that meeting in the White House, and it was brought up early, and it's really important that we point this out. Whatever could have happened in the White House with the president over that four-hour meeting, it needed to be approved by the policy board. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of talk tonight about that as well. But I think the main item that you might see action on, at least today or over the next few days, is changing the format for the Tour Championship. And we batted it around for quite a while, and I have to give the Tour credit. They finally responded, and they're coming up with something new.
It seems like the Tour Championship format is always under construction, so we'll see what unfolds after the meeting today. Rex, Lav, always good to be with you, too.
Thanks, guys.
Well, as we go to break, we want to pass along that the Cognizant Classic of the Palm Beaches announced today that the 2025 recipient of the Tim Rosefort Distinguished Journalism Award will be Jeff Babineau. Babs was a longtime golf writer who passed away on December 9th of 2024 at the age of 62. He will be honored at a ceremony to be held tomorrow at the tournament's Tim Rosefort Media Center.